This is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Lori Elster. And this is the All Access Star Trek podcast. Today we have a lot of news thanks to that big Variety cover story on Star Trek. And we're going to play clips from our interviews at the Star Trek Discovery Season 5 junket that happened a couple of weeks ago. But let's start with the news. It was pretty amazing to see that Star Trek was the cover story on Variety.
Yeah, it's worth reading the whole article. The cover of Variety this week is this kind of cool black cover with the Star Trek badge that says, "Does Star Trek still matter?" And they really lifted the kimono for this guy. I mean, they invited him to the sets in Toronto, into the
writer's room.
Yeah, writer's room in Santa Monica. He talked to, you know, Frakes and David Stapp, who's the head of CBS Studios. Alex, obviously. It didn't really talk about animation. There was no direct quotes from Paramount Pictures, no JJ, but there were some sourced bits from the movie, you know, from the Paramount Pictures side, which we'll get into. But it's just worth reading. Some of the business stuff in there was interesting. It says 1 in 5 Paramount Plus subscribers is watching at least one Star Trek show.
And more than 50% of those people are watching at least two others. More than 50% of fans watching one of the new Star Trek shows, let's be clear, also watch at least two others. That was a nice number to hear.
There was also some hard, cold reality in there. I think Frakes is quoted as saying, you know, Star Trek fan, they're not getting any younger or something. I forgot what he had to say, but.
Yeah, basically just saying, yeah, they're not young. Well, let me rephrase that. We're not young.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. I mean, and, you know, hence the Academy show. I mean, the biggest news out of this was.
Well, let's start with the Section 31 movie. Let's start going through some of the stuff we learned. I think the biggest thing that everybody was very surprised to hear is that we're going to see a young Rachel Garrett.
Yes.
I mean, I'm assuming we don't need to tell our listeners who Rachel Garrett is, but should we?
So, you know, it's funny. Yeah, because it's just one episode, but it's such an episode. So yesterday's Enterprise, she was the captain of the Enterprise C. You know, they sent her back in time, you know, and she died, right?
She died before they sent her back in time, but she was willing to go back in time and die.
Right. She died in the future. Yeah, that's right. Castillo had to captain the ship back in time.
And Yar went with him. So it was a big episode, big story, set up all kinds of other stuff. And then we saw her. There was a statue in Picard.
She's a famous captain of the Enterprise, but not one we ever really got to know. Her story is a mid-24th century story, pre-TNG. So people are thinking, oh, that must be, which people often call the lost era, kind of between Star Trek VI and The Next Generation. There's kind of like 70 years, roughly 80 years in there of history. And, you know, every once in a while, a story will dip into that Tuvok's time on on Sulu's ship and all that kind of stuff. But does this mean the Section 31 movie is set in that era? I'm going to bet no, it's not.
Yeah, I assume they're jumping around.
Someone has suggested, I like this idea, it's kind of like a Bill and Ted's thing. You got you got Giorgio jumping through time, grabbing different people from different times and using, you know, them on her adventure or something like that.
Right.
The actress who's playing Rachel Garrett, Casey Roll, who I remember her from The Magicians, she's good. But she was one of the people who was announced, you know, when they announced seven actors. So, you know, I started thinking, when you start looking at the other six actors, maybe we should do an article on this of like, what are they, you know, what famous people are they playing?
Oh, that's a great idea. I'll have to take a closer look at them. I haven't looked at them in a while.
That's 100%. Speculation.
Yes.
For sure.
So, well, here's what we do know is screenwriter Craig Sweeney said that he wanted to make sure that anyone could watch it regardless of how well-versed they are in Trek. Like, he didn't want a barrier to entry. But he did bring up, you know, the darkness of Section 31. And he did say, here's the quote, "It's almost antagonistic to some of the values of Star Trek." But he says, you know, he was curious about the people who exist, who don't quite fit into Roddenberry's utopia. So he wanted to like explore the shades of gray and see the people who are at the edges, as he says, out in the field.
And I have no problem with that, really. You know, it's not going to be all darkness and killing. It's going to, you know, it sounds like it's a lighter tone. It's Mission Impossible, the Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm all up for this now, that especially now that it's a movie, it's not a series.
I'm still nervous about it, I admit, because I didn't love the Section 31 stuff that they did in any of the series.
Yeah, well, see, I did. I loved it. So I really liked the, you know, the DS9 stuff. So the first image from this movie came out, and it's Michelle Yeoh and the back of some guy's head.
Could be a guy. A person's head.
Yeah, a being's head, bald.
There you go.
Lots of technology attached to it. Could be a Borg, could be something else. You know, it kind of looks like, you know, the Darth Vader, you know, without
with
his
the helmet.
Helmet
off.
Yeah, you know, it's could it be like they've reconstructed Leland? Remember Leland from Control?
I remember Leland.
Even though she killed him.
She still had his blood on her boots, I think, at the beginning of season 3.
Yeah, maybe she kept a little bit of that. I don't know. You know, who knows what the hell that is?
It's probably, would you want to make another Leland?
I don't. Who knows? It's a kooky sci-fi character is what it looks like.
Yes.
And I think that's what they're going for. Supposedly, there's this opulent nightclub set they built for it, full of familiar Star Trek aliens. It'll be a fun adventure, and we'll see what happens.
And Michelle Yeoh is already like, if they make a sequel, if this is successful, I'm in. So she loves it.
No info on when it's coming. I still think that they could pull this one out before the end of the year, especially now that we know from the same article that Strange New Worlds won't be until 2025, which is no surprise.
Right. All right. Well, let's move on to Starfleet Academy. This article was packed with news. So
yeah,
Starfleet Academy show. So we've had it confirmed, which we already knew, that it takes place in the Discovery era, the 32nd century. The writing staff is a mix, they said, of diehard fans, part-time fans, and newbies, which I think is good.
Yeah, that's what you want in a writer's room.
Yeah.
We know, according to Tawny Newsom, that, you know, she and others are quote unquote canon cops. But you know, especially because they're going after a YA audience, and the showrunner talked about that in a way, part of the reason why 32nd Century works for them is because, if you remember, this is going to be set on Earth in San Francisco, and Earth was only recently reintroduced to the Federation.
Right.
You know, generations have grown up on Earth just being Earthicans, you know, or whatever they called themselves.
Earthanians.
So, you know, so the Federation is new to them. Starfleet is new to them. You know, it sounds very similar to Prodigy, right? Where they're being, you know, these students are going to be learning about Starfleet and Starfleet's ways and Starfleet technology along with the audience.
Right. It'll introduce them for the first time. And apparently, like, the sets, they're planning on taking up all the space at Pinewood Studio in Toronto, which is the largest studio in Canada. They have all this, like a sprawling two-story structure that will have a mess hall and an amphitheater and trees and catwalks and classrooms and a view and all this stuff in one big space, which is amazing.
You know, you've seen behind-the-scenes videos of the Pinewood
stage. I've been there.
It's a giant, giant building, both the Shenzo set and the Discovery set.
The Klingon ship was there. It was gigantic.
Yeah, all in this one room. It'll be fascinating to see what they do with this. It's going to be the largest set ever made for Star Trek, certainly, if not for anything. They're going to be using the air wall, and they're going to be also doing ship stuff, too. So it won't all be based on that set.
Yeah, they didn't want people worrying that there wouldn't be any ships.
There'll be ships because, you know, it's
people like ships.
It's Star Trek.
Speaking of Strange New Worlds, we did get to see some new stuff. There's a new science lab in season 3, and there's this picture of Spock in it. And it's described as a transparent floor atop a 4-foot pool of water that swirls underneath the central workbench with all these view screens around it with live schematics. It's very exciting.
It's cool looking. I mean, yeah, I hope they there's a reason why a pool of water, like especially being a science lab, that just can't be a, ooh, you know, that looks cool.
Cetacean ops. Here we go.
Like maybe there's a special water-based computer it's running on or, you know.
Or a creature.
Maybe. Yeah. Right. There's a few little tidbits. Frakes is directing an episode that he said is the best thing he's ever done as a director on television. It's a murder mystery described as a Hollywood murder mystery. I don't know if that means it's like set in Hollywood or it's just a classic Hollywood murder mystery, which is a genre Star Trek could easily do. And I think there's been some kind of stuff like that before. Yeah. That's not really a big swing, as they like to say.
As they like to say a lot. Well, so then Akiva was asked, you know, what else they could do. And he seems to think it's wide open. And some of the things he just threw out there, just frivolously, I guess, was like, Muppets? Sure. Black and white? Yeah. Silent? Slapstick? Sure. So I'm not sure I want to watch a silent episode or a slapstick episode. They've done black and white with Bride of Chaotica.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a reason. Slapstick, they've actually done. The puppet thing, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, they did it on Angel.
Was it good? Did you watch it? I didn't watch Angel.
I don't know. I kind of remember watching
it. Were they
it.
All puppets? Were all the characters puppets?
Yeah. Because that show had magic and someone cast a spell or something and everyone became a puppet. Very Muppety puppet, too.
Anyway, I got the feeling he was not throwing out specific ideas that he discussed. I felt like it was he was just.
Oh, no, I bet you that every single one of those was things they've talked about, but not necessarily things they've decided to do. Certainly not season three things.
Oh, no. Yeah. Agreed.
These would be season four crazy ideas on their crazy idea wall.
On the big swing wall.
Big swing.
They just have a big pendulum that goes back and forth.
Strange New Worlds is turning along. So there was a bit of feature film stuff, a little bit of clarity on stuff we've talked about before. So we've said before that Paramount has two movies in development, a Star Trek IV movie and what has been described as a kind of origin story separate movie. We now have a little bit more info on that one. That one is being directed by the guy who did USS Callister. Now it's being described as an origin story for the franchise.
Right.
As a whole, and that it's set in the Prime universe. So they didn't use the word Prime. I think they described it as like the regular universe or the main universe.
Before the Kelvin attack.
Because, of course, as we saw in Beyond, Star Trek Enterprise exists in the same timeline as the Chris Pine crew because that's before they split.
Right. So what do you like origin story for the franchise?
Well, I mean, you know, what is an origin story? You think of big moments. You know, they already did First Contact, World War III and the Eugenics War. Is that really the origin? I think the most obvious one is Romulan War. Enterprise season 6 and 5, you know, what they never got a chance to do. I'm not saying Scott Bakula is going to show up, but that's kind of the start of the Federation, right?
Right. But then wouldn't the origin story have to go before Enterprise?
Enterprise was leading up to the Romulan War, but they never got there.
I know. But if you're calling it an origin story for the franchise, it should start before Enterprise. I mean, who knows what they mean by that? It's a confusing phrase.
I think that they would be talking about the foundations of Starfleet and the Federation.
Right, but that's not what they said. They didn't say the origin story of Starfleet or the origin story of the Federation.
Well, this is a throwaway line. They're not being specific. Right. So I think that's it's a shorthand. I think it's a shorthand. This is all speculation. The key thing is that this quote unquote origin story is ironically further ahead now at Paramount, even though the direct sequel to Beyond has been in development for 8 years, but they just hired yet another writer. He's done some good stuff. Did that show Flight Attendant, and
he's the guy doing the Kelvin sequel, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm saying,
sorry, I just didn't want to mix up the two.
Yeah, no, it is confusing, admittedly, but I'm saying the reason why that Kelvin movie is not happening first is because it's going through another round of writing with a new scriptwriter. It actually said, I mean, we've heard this before, that the origin story movie would be shooting later by the end of this year. And doing the math, as we talked about last time, if they want to get a movie out by the 60th anniversary by 2026, that could work.
We'll see. I mean, I feel like a lot of fans, which is like, I'll believe it when I see it. But the quote that I thought was interesting about the movies was that they said the studio is now, here's the quote, focused on right-sizing the budgets to fit within the clear box office ceiling.
It did note that no Star Trek movies broken through the $500 million mark. I think they can, but probably not a lot. Certainly not up to a billion. But
right. Well, it's about what they spend, too. So it's the kind of story they decide to tell and where they prioritize their budget choices.
Which was kind of what they were doing with Noah Hawley, and then they told him to leave.
I know. Why?
I don't know. You know, this is fascinating, but it's kind of, they've been around the block so many times, it's getting confusing. But I'm glad they're being realistic instead of saying, let's go for a billion again and then get disappointed and wait another 10 years. The crazy thing is that apparently there's a third movie.
I was just going to say, so remember the one, I think the last time we talked about this, we couldn't remember her name, but it's Kalinda Vasquez. And she has her movie still in development officially, they say, whatever that actually means.
Yeah, because the Noah Hawley movie dead, the
Tarantino movie dead.
You know, so it's not dead, whatever that means. Could be fantastic. Who knows?
We don't know. And in the meantime, Alex Kurtzman is still looking at opportunities for TV movies, for Star Trek TV movies, and did include Legacy as a possibility.
Well, a Picard spinoff. The word Legacy did not appear.
No. Good point.
You know, kind of just like when George Cheeks was asked about Legacy, no one's actually said that they don't like to say the word.
Right. I mean, at least Alex knows what it is. But yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unlike George Cheeks, who's like, what? Oh, there's one thing we haven't talked about. I mean, we mentioned that there was no mention of animation in this huge Variety piece. There's a little bit of news. We actually haven't posted this on the site because we've been trying to get some clarity on this, but
yeah, there's still some information gathering happening.
So season 2 of Star Trek Prodigy has yet to be announced on Netflix when that's coming. Last week I joked, I said they're done dubbing and you know, it's now ready to in Uzbek.
Yeah.
Apparently when they were finished dubbing, they sent it out. And when the people in France got it, they're like, cool. And they put the whole thing online. Then there's a question of, is this a leak or not a leak?
No, and the fans on social were going nuts and angry at people who posted it. And the Hagemans, who were trying to figure out what was going on because they didn't know, asked people, please don't share it.
Yeah, this is a weird situation where it's not technically a leak, but this was definitely not the plan. It's weird.
Well,
but
it was somebody's plan.
So what it looks like happened is that an old deal was in place. A broadcaster in France who would be getting what they call in the business the second window. Because Prodigy Season 2 should be out.
Right.
So when they got it, they're like, sure, we'll put it out. You know, not knowing that the first window never happened. It never showed up on Paramount Plus, nor is it yet to be on Netflix. It was always meant to be broadcast after it was streamed, but because it hasn't been streamed, this happened. It's only available in French. Right. We're not going to report on spoilers for this. This isn't how the artists intended it for it to be rolled out. So we're not going to wallow in all the spoilers of it all.
Yeah, someone sent me the French episode titles, and I do speak a little French, so I just deleted it because I'd rather just not know until we know. And the main thing is, look, even if you, let's say you speak French and you found a way to get these episodes, here's what I would ask you if you're in the States. Please still watch it on Netflix when it comes out and give it the views.
and watch it in French if you want.
Yes, watch it in French, enjoy it, don't spoil it for anybody else, and also watch it on Netflix.
And also, if you see some of these titles and stuff, they're like translated using Google. Apparently, some of the translations are poor translations. So just wait until it's, you know, released in your country the way it's supposed to be, I would say.
Yeah.
But if you're in France, you know, knock yourself out. It's there. It's available. It's in French. Ooh la la.
Yeah. C'est la vie.
Don't jump on Twitter and say, oh, look who showed up in episode 5. Right. You know,
look, it's this legacy person that you never imagined was coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not do that.
All right. I think it's time to talk Star Trek Discovery. Next week, we'll be reviewing the first 2 episodes of season 5, which debut on April 4th on Paramount Plus. There's some stuff on the website. Like there's Michelle Paradise did little hinty stuff. We know the names of the 10 episodes. That was reported in like January or something. But now she gave us little hints.
There were a couple that popped for me, I thought. So she said episode 5, which is called Mirrors. And then she said, I'm trying to think of something that won't be spoilery. Surprising encounters and surprising new information about our heroes.
Okay, so obviously it's in the Mirror Universe.
That's what I would think, yes.
Anything else pop for you?
Episode 9, LaGrange Point. It's a discovery in a location where you've never seen her before. I mean, is the location LaGrange Point? I'm up for that. I like the idea of a location I've never seen before.
I think it's probably a kooky sci-fi phenomenon type situation, space phenomenon, because it's something that the ship is caught in, whether it's a giant green hand or whatever. But
oh, I hope it's a giant green hand.
But it's probably some more scientific-y thingy. I'm guessing it's a LaGrange point. It's going to be between two. Now, in the trailer, there's a thing where you could see two black holes. And there would be a LaGrange point in between two black holes. And maybe there's something special about that kind of a LaGrange point. A LaGrange point is a point of equilibrium between two gravitational bodies. So maybe something kooky happens in between two black holes.
Cool. Well, that would be something we haven't seen, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Because we've seen a web and a giant hand and all kinds of other crazy things.
So now we're going to roll in audio from interviews that Lori and I did at a Discovery junket. There's some minor spoilers here because every once in a while there's a discussion of the first 4 episodes, but we're not going to include anything that got too specific.
Yes. So the people that were there were Alex Kurtzman and Michelle Paradise, Sonequa on her own. Doug Jones and David Ajala were together, and then Wilson Cruz, Mary Wiseman, and Blue Del Barrio were together, and Anthony Rapp was away in Tokyo at the time.
And these are group interviews, so you're not going to be hearing Lori. Lori and I asked some of these questions. Some were asked by our other friends in the media. We're just going to be rolling in the audio of the answers, and let's start with Alex and Michelle.
And sort of what we are thinking is coming in season 5.
We definitely knew that we wanted to do a quest season, and obviously, you know, probably the greatest quest ever committed to film is the Indiana Jones movies. So I think there was some of that influence there. Certainly the idea of a quest, you know, and the idea of putting pieces together in a giant puzzle to get to a reveal.
Yeah, we did. We sort of internally talked about it as an Indiana Jones type season because of that, and because that series of films is known for its adventure. And we wanted to have fun with that and kind of explore a shifted tonal direction from previous seasons, while of course maintaining all of the things that make Discovery Discovery. You know, we didn't know going into this season that it would be our last, but thematically, we explore very big things, meaning where we come from, things like that. And then, you know, any given season, we look at how those things are going to play out with each character and their particular arcs. So I do think at the end of the day, it's going to feel very satisfying. You know, and as you may be aware, we did get a chance to shoot some additional material to wrap up the series itself. But I think people will feel really good about how it's all wrapping up and that it tells a complete series story for each of our beloved characters.
For my personal storyline, for Saru's storyline throughout season five, it felt like, you know, this could be a good finale for him before I knew it was our finale. Yeah. And so when I heard it was like, well, you know, that kind of almost makes sense, you know, for me personally, selfishly. Mm-hmm. And then for the whole show, we had the luxury of going back and filming a little epilogue or a coda, they were calling it, that we could tack on to the last episode that gives you the watcher, the audience, a sense of closure for the whole series. Yeah.
So the reason this came up in terms of it feeling like a final season, we weren't the only ones to ask about it. Tony and I both noticed, and I think we mentioned this in our spoiler-free review, but that it does, there are many scenes that do feel like, oh, they must have known. Like, it does feel like there's a finality to it. So that is why they addressed that, because we were curious, like if they had maybe an inkling, but they say they didn't.
It was subconscious. They were, you know.
Like the fact that they thought it wasn't there is strange to me, because it seems really obvious.
Assuming you're always going to get another season seems folly to me.
Right. And I think, you know, you're right that it could have been subconscious, that it just kind of crept in because it's a just-in-case thing. Because you never know. I mean, no one making any show knows. Unless they've been renewed for more than one season. They don't know.
Well, when they made seasons one and two, they knew. You know, they had been given the soft thumbs up. You're going to get another season.
Right.
But even with season four, the way season four ended, that could have been a series finale.
Right. But I don't think it had that feel the whole way through. Episode to episode.
Agreed.
And that's the difference. That's what we noticed. Anyway, the next thing we got them to talk about was the introduction of this new character, Rainer. And I'm assuming you asked that question.
Yes.
to find out what he brings to the mix. So let's listen to that.
I asked Mary and Wilson this.
I think Rainer brings some much needed grumpiness and curmudgeonliness. A lot of us are very like starry-eyed optimists, and it's nice to have just an old battle axe. So that creates just like really fun dynamics between that character and the rest of the crew, who are used to working together, who run like a clock. And now there's this person who's highly competent, but has a very different conversation style, problem-solving approach. And Callum is a great actor and really fun to work with and an absolute maniac. And so that was really fun. This was like great new guy to bring into the fold. And I think people will really enjoy his character and the dynamics it brings out of everyone.
Yeah, he was so much fun to work with. Aside from his funky ears that he brought to set every day, I think what was fun to watch is how this character has to fit themselves into a new power structure, right? This is, you know, the way that Burnham runs that ship is unlike the way that most ships are run. It's a soft power. I hate that word, but it's the best way to describe it. You know, how does someone who has a bit of an aggressive, combative style of leadership fit themselves into a power structure in which you know, there's less power coming from above and more of a center, you know, center out power structure. So it was fun to watch that character navigate this new power structure they find themselves in.
Yeah, from what I've seen from the first four episodes and from what they're saying, I think this was a brilliant move, great introduction, great actor, great character.
Agree. Totally agree. I mean, there's nothing else to say. Just love him and you will enjoy him when you watch him.
It was funny watching them all light up when they get a chance to talk about him. Maybe it's just fun to have a new toy to play with on set, but it seems to have been a fun thing for them as well.
Yeah, and it's the thing I noticed about him is that you just feel like you want to, you would put him with anybody and you would enjoy whatever scene ensued. All right, so then Wilson and Mary and Blue talked about sort of where they start out this new season.
I think there's been a few months have passed when we re-meet our heroes at the opening of season 5, and I feel like as you look around, that everyone is in a much more stable place in terms of how they feel about themselves and their place on the ship and in this new future. I mean, we've definitely gotten the kinks out of being 900 years away from everything and everyone we love. So when this mystery finds us, we are well suited and well prepared to take on this task. So, you know, in terms of Hugh, I think that means that he continues to ask these existential questions, these big life questions. And as a man of science, you know, it's always more comfortable when there's a yes or no to these questions. And really his journey this season is about finding grace in the unknown, in the questions that are incapable of being answered, and what that means for him in the way that he views his life.
Avery, go ahead.
For Tilly,
Sorry about that.
Oh, sorry. Did you?
No, you go ahead. I apologize. You guys go ahead.
Tilly comes back to Star Trek Discovery. And is trying to figure out how to get through to her students who have become isolated from growing up during the burn. And she's trying to figure that out, how to help them with that.
And Adira is in a much more confident state, I think, with their position on the ship than we have ever seen them, and they're taking on more responsibilities, they're being given more things to do, and kind of being pushed a bit more in a way that I think they wanted to be pushed, and on the side dealing with some personal issues and just some emotional stuff. I think that they do a lot of self-reflection at the start of the season.
In addition to those three talking about their character arcs for the season, here's a bit of Doug Jones talking specifically about the Saru-Tarina love story.
This love story has been meant the world to me. I didn't. That's the one wish I had for Saru throughout this entire series. Is can he find love? You know, and when you're playing an alien, non-human species, it's nice to have a love story. It's rare. It's more rare. So so coupling him with a Vulcan. Perfection. I thought maybe they're both very diplomatic and they're both very poised and proper. But you're right. He has, I don't think his protection, he does mention wanting to be protective of her, and she's very adamant in telling him she does not need my protection. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I needed to hear that. But the instinct to protect is not just one of like, I got this. You're too weak to protect yourself. Mm. It was not that at all. It was more out of just a place of love. Like, I care about you. I hope you would protect me as well when the time comes.
Well, I'm holding out for a happy ending for those two. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I think one's coming. Yeah.
You know what I remember is that you were the first person I knew who noticed the chemistry between Tarina and Saru, and that it just kind of happened on screen anyway, and that the writers came to it afterwards. But I feel like, you know, you were the original shipper.
And yet, have they invited me to any of their events? No dinner parties with Taru and Serena? Serena and Taru.
There you go. You're already figuring out their couple name.
Right. No, I think it. There's a great fun... Well, fun is a weird word, but just a sweet chemistry between them.
Yeah, I would agree. Next up, you know, we wanted to know where the characters are going and how they've changed. And Sonequa did a really nice kind of wrap up, and then Wilson and David Ajala also had things to say about what's happening to their characters. So let's listen to that.
It's like you really can see this growth. You can see the growth that this character went through. What a gift that they gave me, that they gave Burnham, that they gave the audience to be able to see this kind of growth. And then you can imagine it, like I said a moment ago, you can imagine it with all of the characters. I mean, think about how far Saru came. He was a completely different Kelpian from where he is now after he went through, you know, after he went through his transformation. And, you know, Colbert went from death to life, literally, as well. And we see Tilly as this sort of scared, you know, girl who becomes this leader, this woman, you know. We see the journey that Adira takes. We see the journey that Stamets takes from this critical person to this beautiful, sensitive, you know, scientist. It's it's one of my favorite things. It's one of my favorite things about Discovery, and I just feel so blessed that I was able to watch these artists create and that I was able to create what I did. What I felt like I was reminded of by playing Hugh is that at any given moment, on any given day, we can all decide that we want to do something differently, that we want, that we deserve more from our lives, and that we are capable of making those changes and choices at any given moment. And that, you know, if things aren't working the way that you're supposed to, or that you think that they're supposed to, that you can decide in that moment that you want something differently and change it. That second chances are real, that you can give them to yourself even. And as an actor, I feel, you know, this was the first time ever that I've been given the privilege, really, of seeing a character throughout 5 seasons. You know, I was one-hit wonders from here on, you know, before this. And it was really gratifying to see him grow and to see his change from season to season. And I knew where I wanted him to end up when it was all over. And despite the fact that we didn't know this was going to be our last season, I'm so gratified by the fact that who I envisioned him to be at the end of the series really shows up here at the end of season 5.
I guess what's really special and a gift for an actor is to be able to have that peripheral or outside perspective. With Cleveland Booker, he's someone who operates on the underbelly of society. And being able to have that experience and then to be able to come into this world where things are done in a certain particular way, he's able to weigh up the two, which contrasts so extreme with the two. He's able to look at the two and see the benefits of both. And I think the glorious thing which happens in season 5, he is able to see without being prompted, without being persuaded, to see the benefits of being part of Starfleet. And I think that is a testament to what Starfleet stands for. There's someone who could be so tunnel visioned in their perspective can kind of humbly fold under the togetherness of Starfleet.
So, I mean, I don't know if I'm reading in between the lines. This is certainly not in the first 4 episodes, but I'm going to put my money down on Book joining Starfleet by the end of the season.
Ooh, that would be nice.
Making it official, putting a ring on it.
It does kind of fit. That's an interesting idea. We did see him in the uniform very briefly once.
I mean, the whole job of a courier is pointless now because everyone's got dilithium, right?
Right.
So he can't go back to his old life. He can't go back to his old planet.
Interesting.
I mean, it could be they could go all the way and he's like her first officer, you know.
Yeah, well, that was my next thought, of course. Although, you know, I'm the first one to say, like, Janeway and Chakotay can't be together because you can't have a captain with their first officer.
And you then I'm shouldn't. Like, that's for sure. But then, I know. You know, if there's any show that's going to do it, it's going to be this
true.
One.
True. And looking back at what Wilson said, just to go back to that, you know, he talked about how getting a second chance and doing something different and changing it. And I wonder how much of that is also that within the show that first season, he really didn't develop his character that much. And then second season was kind of about him being messed up. So it's nice that he finally gets to sort of explore who he is later.
He wasn't much of a character. He was more of an addendum to Stamets.
Yeah.
Then Hugh became a very interesting character who believes he's the chief medical officer, even though no one has told him.
Good for him.
He just walks into sick bay. I'm chief medical officer. Everyone's like, okay. I thought it was her. Whatever.
It's all good. So we have some stuff where we have Sonequa and David Agel and Doug Jones talking about Michael's relationship with each of their characters. And we just want to warn you that in the Sonequa section that comes up first, there is definitely a spoiler. It's not a huge plot spoiler, and it's something that happens fairly quickly. But we want you to be warned. So you are warned.
Well, I mean, I have so much love and respect for Doug Jones and David Ajala. And, you know, I mean, that goes across the board, you know, because there's also a really special relationship between Burnham and Tilly. But I, you know, with Saru and with Book, you know, I love what we see toward the beginning of season 5 when it's time for Saru to fulfill his purpose. It's time for him to, you know, reach his own destiny, you know, with his own people. And, I love that as he exits, it's time for Burnham to rise in a way like never before. Because now the guide is gone, the shepherd is gone, the sort of big brother is gone, the voice of reason is gone. And now it's time for her to do those things, be those things herself and give them to somebody else. It's almost as if Saru's exit just from the ship signals her stepping into a mentor role, her stepping into the role of guide and shepherd and teacher, the one who's reaching out to someone and pulling them forward, pulling them their true selves out of them. Right. And so I love that Burnham and Book also do that for each other. They're iron sharpening iron. It's super complicated between them. There's a lot going on between them, but they ultimately make each other better. And I love that. I love that about those dynamics.
They both have different experiences with Michael Burnham. And I guess the experience that Michael Burnham will have with Cleveland Booker, no matter how their relationship plays out, is he has inspired her to be the most authentic version of herself, to embrace that, to be at peace with that, to understand that you can be a leader, you can be vulnerable, you may not know all the answers at the same time, you may make mistakes, you may be liked, disliked, all of those things can exist at the same time, not one existing exclusively without the other. Their relationship is a relationship that's built upon kindness, truth, honesty, and love. So they're always going to be in each other's lives. And I think their relationship is a relationship that can stand the test of time.
Yeah. And different from their mad, passionate love story, Saru and Burnham are very, very more like siblings who have gone through the phases of competition and being at each other's throats a little bit and being jealous of mom's attention, you know, or whatever. And then growing into, oh, we've been through life and death together. We've had disagreements, and then we've had coming back togethers again many a time over the course of the series. And we've protected each other. We have gone through so much so that when it comes to a place in season 5 where change might be afoot for Saru, where he has an opportunity coming, what does he do with that? His tether to the Starship Discovery really is her. Mm. And so a moment comes, won't say what or why, but where he expresses a sense of family with her by touching foreheads with her, something that we Kelpians do. I did it with my sister, Sarana, in an earlier previous season. And also with Sukal, my young protege that we found and I helped him become a Kelpian again and find himself among our people. Forehead touches. It's not a romantic thing, it's a family thing. Mm. And so there's a moment where Burnham and Saru, where I guide her into a forehead touch that was really, really quite touching for both of us.
You know, so even though we said it's a spoiler, it's been fairly telegraphed.
Yes.
That the synopsis of the first episode is Saru gets this offer, which he talked about in an interview, to have this special role within the Federation, and he leaves the ship. But he's still part of the cast and part of all of the episodes that we've seen. He's just not on the Discovery. he's somewhere else. So that adds a new dynamic.
Yeah.
I think it's a good way to shake up some of the dynamics for the season is to shuffle some characters around.
Yep, I agree. And I loved that David's description of his relationship with, of Book's relationship with Michael Barnum. I just love those two. So I want them to stay together.
I think they will. They First better. Officer and captain. I'm calling it.
Okay. So this was one of my favorite questions that I heard asked. It was actually asked by Ashley, who I worked with on Trek Talk. So it's so nice when you go into those junket things and you recognize the people that you're talking to. So, but she asked David and Doug about being examples of positive masculinity. And I'll tell you, when she said it, David Ajala reached out to fist bump Doug. But you have to hear their answers to her question about it.
Thank you for thinking I'm masculine at all. Very sweet of you. But positive masculinity. Yes, I believe that Saru does lead and lets others lead according to level of skill, level of wisdom. Whoever in the room has that, that's who should take it. So even in my relationship with President Tarina, she takes the lead often in our because she knows better than I do in many, many situations. And so to be a male figure who can be confident in that moment, great.
And I know, Ashley, you know, we celebrated that moment by having a little fist bump on a fun level, but, you know, with a level more meaningful, piggybacking off what Doug was saying, it is true to be able to, we both have women who are very strong, who are leaders. Behind every good, great woman is herself. Michael Burnham doesn't need Cleveland Booker. However, they do bring out the best in each other. And I think it's a really wonderful trait, characteristic for Cleveland Booker to comfortably allow and encourage his lady, his partner, his kindred spirit to thrive. I think it's a very sexy, powerful trait.
You know, it's funny that David Ajala says it's a sexy trait, because I also remember, like, the last round of junkets for the season before, I guess, I remember asking him, like, oh, is it going to be hard for Book if his girlfriend's the captain now? And I wish I could remember the exact phrase, but he said something like, I'd like to butter that crumpet, or something like that in his delightful British accent. So his point was, no, that just makes her sexier. And it's why I love the question and I love their answers, because I think they really show, like, David Ajala, especially to me, I find him really attractive and he's very masculine, but he's not in any way like a gross dude. He's like a full-on enlightened character.
Yeah. Michael doesn't need him, but she needs him. That makes any sense.
So, you know, in addition to showing masculinity in a really positive, strong way on the show, there are other things they do. And there's a lot of talk about Discovery's representation. And sometimes for me, it can be easy to just, because I think of myself as an enlightened person, then I think, well, I don't need all that because I already know it and I'm good. And the thing I forget, and I think it was really important that Blue brought it up, is what a character like Adira does for certain fans. And so, you know, Blue has had some really nice dealings with fans and explains why in a poignant way that I think reminds the rest of us of why this representation is important.
First of all, the best possible interactions, because the fans of our show and Trek fans in general are just like the best people in the world and are so kind and caring and compassionate. The best experiences that I've had are something that I did not expect to happen, but, cause I would get, messages from, other trans people, which is amazing. What I was not really anticipating was getting messages from parents of trans kids who would watch the show and say that it was helping them to better understand their kid or have more transparent interactions with their kid or with their family member. And that to me means more than anything else I've ever heard has meant. Like it, I, it's just not something I ever expected, especially, like, you know, struggling with my own parents as a kid and, like, still now a little bit. That's crazy to me, that I had some small part in that and that it could have that kind of effect. But yeah, that's definitely the most meaningful to me.
I thought what Blue had to say was very sweet about Star Trek fans, especially because I can imagine Blue is being diplomatic, because I'm sure they've had some interactions which have not been fantastic as well.
Oh, horrible. I'm sure absolutely horrible. And this show and this cast gets the worst of it anyway. But Blue, for sure.
So the final thing we have is a bit of Alex going beyond Discovery, because Discovery started it all. All the shows that he produces now kind of began with Discovery in 2017. So he talks about that legacy.
When we made Discovery, we weren't actually setting out to build a universe. We were just setting out to make a new Star Trek show. And I think that in sort of tacking along the different roads that Discovery gave us, the fact that we were able to bring Pike and Spock and Number One into the show, one of the writers that I had worked with, actually Akiva, before we even cast Pike, said, you know, there's a great Star Trek show with Pike in the lead and the entire era on the Enterprise before Kirk takes over. And I said, why don't we cast a good Pike first, see how that works, and then we'll go from there. And that ended up obviously becoming Strange New Worlds, but that could never have happened without season two of Discovery. Never. And I think that one of the things that we have really loved is, you know, I believe strongly that every Star Trek show needs to have its own very unique identity. I don't want you to ever think that, you know, you can watch one show and get your fill of Star Trek and therefore don't have to watch the others. Each one has to have its own identity, but, you know, the key to that is not making one show that's supposed to please everybody, right? If you make one show where you try and please everybody, you're ultimately going to please nobody. So each of these shows is really designed and targeted to access a very specific part of the fandom. And there's a real misnomer about Trek fandom, which is it's this generic term you can apply to everybody. There are so many different subsets of Trek fans. And so I think the idea with the rainbow of shows that we're doing is to appeal to each subset without necessarily having to, you know, to get everybody in the door. Discovery led the way in so many ways. You know, it really pointed us as a compass toward what was possible. And that has been incredibly exciting for us. And so now we're on this wild adventure and we're in the middle of shooting Section 31 and we're halfway through the writing of the first season of Starfleet Academy, and we start shooting that at the end of the summer. So then there's more up behind that. So it's been pretty amazing.
So just to clear that up, he does say we're in the middle of shooting Section 31, but obviously he said that when they were in the middle of shooting Section 31, and since then they finished it.
We did these a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an interesting thought about each show having its own identity and not making one show that's supposed to please everybody, because that is a different tactic from 90s Trek.
Yeah. They just wanted more for the same audience. I was saying today in our Slack, I would be happy if I didn't like the Starfleet Academy show, if they successfully did what they are out going to do, which is to get the kinds of people who loved Riverdale and that type of show to love Star Trek. Will that also work for me? Now, Tawny says they're trying to thread the needle and make it work for everyone, but I'm okay if they nail job one, which is bring in lots of 16-year-old Star Trek fans. And that's kind of what Alex is saying, is that it's hard to please everyone.
Especially Star Trek fans. But yeah. Yes. No, it is. I mean, I do like some YA stuff, so I'm hoping that it will appeal to me like that. I mean, there's only one season. That Amazon show Paper Girls comes to mind, which I really liked. And I like things like Never Have I Ever and stuff like that.
I liked the Hunger Games movies, you know, which are based on YA books. I guess, would you consider that a YA franchise? But I'm just saying.
Oh, like Percy Jackson's a good example. Sure. Right? That's total YA. And the show was fantastic. The books are great. So it is possible, but I do know what you mean. Like, I get what you're saying. I think it's legit. It's just to be like, I'm not the audience. So if I love it, maybe they're targeting the wrong people.
Yeah, I'm sure if you roll back the tape on Prodigy before it debuted, I said a similar thing. Pretty sure I said almost exactly the same thing now that I think about it. And then I turned out to be loving Prodigy. And that could quite possibly happen again with this show. But as we talked about at the top of this thing, you know, as covered by Variety, the franchise is old and so are many of its fans. And so anything that brings in new fans is good. You know, I mean, one of the great things that the J.J. Abrams movies did is bring in a bunch of new fans.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Part of the reason why there was a big draw for Star Trek for the streaming service that CBS was launching is because they were leveraging on the increased popularity for the franchise that came out of the J.J. movies.
100%.
What did Kirk say? Young minds, fresh ideas?
I think so.
So let's all keep an optimistic point of view on that. The other side of that is it okay for there to be two shows that appeal to the same group? So, because one of the arguments is, well, you know, do they need legacy? Isn't Strange New Worlds enough for the old fans? And I would say, no, it's not enough.
Yeah.
Please target multiple groups, but don't. But don't one is not enough.
Don't leave us out in the cold. Yeah. Us oldies.
Exactly.
Make stuff for us too. I mean, I always, you know, I do love Prodigy. I love Lower Decks. I always find something to enjoy. But yes, make lots of stuff for us. Please.
So it's time for our bits of the week. Mine, it's kind of Star Trek adjacent. The sci-fi show that I've been really excited about for the last week is Three Body Problem on Netflix. It's great. It's based on some hard sci-fi books. It's a difficult adaptation to do, but I think they really nailed it, and I highly recommend it. But if you are looking for a connection, Rosalind Chow, Keiko O'Brien, has an important role, very important role on the show, and there's a great interview with her in Vanity Fair, of all places, and she talks a bit about Star Trek, something I didn't know. She had auditioned for Tashi Yar and was called back for it. And said, nah, I don't want to do it.
Well, she couldn't come. She was somewhere where it wouldn't have been convenient for her, she said. Well,
yeah, but I mean, a series regular on a TV show, she could have gotten on an airplane. She was in London, but they brought her back still. And, you know, the rest is history, as it were.
She's great. That interview is by Jordan Hoffman.
Yeah.
Who we know as used to host a Star Trek podcast, writes about Star Trek, used to work for the site, all that stuff. And a very nice fellow, I would like to add. Yes. All right. Well, mine is a birthday present I received from my husband, which I just want to tell you about because it's so great. But it's an Enterprise D Bluetooth speaker. So not only like I listen to music all day on a Bluetooth speaker so I can connect it to my phone or my computer and listen to music. It lacks some bass. I won't pretend it's not missing some bass when you're trying to listen to music. So it's not the perfect sound, but when you connect it to Bluetooth, you get Majel Barrett's voice saying incoming transmission. And it has all these other features, like it'll play 60 minutes of sort of warp background noise in case you want to go to sleep. You can fire photon torpedoes and hear that sound, engine hum, like all these different things. And then my favorite review that I read of it on Amazon, the person wrote, "Lights and sound are terrific. Wish I did not have to give it to my friend, hoping he has it already so I can keep it." But it's just very fun and it makes great sounds and it makes my office look even nerdier than it already looked.
And it could be yours for the low, low price of $70.
Yes.
On Amazon.
Yes. It was one of the presents that my husband got me.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
It's fun.
So that's it.
Wait, one note before we go. I don't know who listens. I don't know if the listeners of this podcast are the same people who are doing this, but here's what I want to say is if you don't like Star Trek Discovery and we put up a news story about it, please don't rush to the site to write about how much you don't like it. Like, enough. I see so much of it, and I see it all over the web, everywhere. It's not just our site. But you know what? You like a show? Go talk about it. People want to talk about it. They don't want to hear for the 85th time that it's not your favorite thing.
Right, and especially because there are people who want to talk about the show. And as we go through the season, we're going to be posting episode reviews. If we see that kind of stuff on the site, we'll probably just start getting rid of it. If it's just people who are clear, they're not watching the show. They don't want to talk about that episode. They just want to shit on the people who are, you know, trying to talk about the show and make them feel bad.
It's such a weird phenomenon. Like, there are a lot of things I don't watch, and I don't go looking for people writing about them so I can say, I hate that show. Like, just don't read it and don't comment on it. That's all we're asking.
Exactly.
But do comment on how much you love our podcast. So yes. Please leave us a review on the site and on Apple. It really helps us. Thank you.
Please. Indeed. And see you next week to talk about two episodes of Star Trek Discovery.
Goodbye.